Blog Talk Radio.
Cosmic Citizens. Welcome to the Cosmic Citizen on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host today, Andre Rodatis, and with me are my co-hosts, Marvin Gowron. Welcome back, Marvin, and Chuck Thurston. Good day, guys.
Hey. Good morning, Andre.
Hi, fellows.
Yes, good morning.
Hey, Marvin.
Yeah.
Fellow travelers, right? Here we are.
Yeah. I have it on good authority that Pam will join us a little bit later in the broadcast. So that will be nice to have her here as well. Paula is off. She and Glenn are on their way to remembering her mother-in-law, Glenn's mom, who passed away, I believe it was last Monday. And so they're heading down to where she was in Pueblo with other members of the family. So we share our condolences and our joy in the graduation of Glenn's mom. Always a wonderful, bittersweet time now for your ancients. And Godspeed to Glenn's mom.
Kind of reminds us, you know, I was just thinking the name of our gathering here is Cosmic Citizens. And, you know, this is just this tiny, tiny first initial step in this cosmic journey that we're on. And, you know, it's always impactful when someone we know or a family member makes that transition, because it puts that reality front and center, you know, that we're on an eternal journey. And we're just here in this life, we're just really putting together the initial sense, the initial understanding. We're just formulating our sense of what we're engaged in. So it's powerful when someone makes that transition. It's always powerful for me.
Yeah. Well, it's a reminder of our mortality, that's for sure.
Absolutely.
But it is a reminder, too. This is just the first, you know, this is just the introduction to an eternal career.
Yes.
So And I want to welcome. At the same time, it's helpful, I think.
Sure. I want to just make sure to welcome to the broadcast Pam Chaddock, our other co-host. Hi, Pam.
Hello, hello. I made it.
Yeah, good. Good.
Yes, good to be
Hi,
here,
Pam.
Friend.
Glad you're here. You're balancing out
yes.
all this male energy, all this.
All right. No problem.
No problem.
Easy.
Good response, too. Oh. So, there have been a number of passings in the Arantia community lately, not all of which I will mention here right now, but one that just happened today, earlier on the other side of the globe in the Philippines, is Nestor Seda. Nestor Seda, who was one of the leaders of the Arantia movement these days in the Philippines, a tireless worker for the revelation. And, you know, when we work with people, there's always a certain amount of controversy, but there was no faulting his spirit of wanting to serve God and wanting to serve the revelation. And he will be missed, I'm sure, in the Philippines. And I just want to extend my condolences to the entire Seda family and to the entire Philippines readership of Urantia Philippines. And I got to meet many of them in November of 2019 at the first national conference of Urantia Philippines. That's where I met Nestor Seda myself, a wonderful man. Very, very humble man of strong opinions, I think would be a fair characterization, but tireless in his fervency for wanting to serve the revelation. In fact, he was going to meet with one of the other readers today, a new reader, always at the ready. So don't know any of the other circumstances, but we wish his family peace and good memories, and we share in their human loss while we also wish Nestor Godspeed on his graduation journey to Mansonia.
Amen. Thanks, Andre.
Yes, thank you so much, Andre.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess we'll all be departing this earth at some point.
I think of popular figures. We just lost the singer Tony Bennett.
Yeah, I saw that.
Made such a contribution to the artistic culture, you know, the musical culture of our planet, particularly North American culture, but all over the world.
He put San Francisco on the map.
Yes, he did. We all have left our heart in San Francisco at one point or another. Yeah. So wonderful.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of an interesting feeling too. I don't know about any of you, but it brings me a sense of being part of a generation, and that we as a generation, you know, I think fondly referred to as the boomers, you know, we've been here, we've had our time to make our impacts, and we've been part of the cultural evolution through this stage, and now we're, as a group, in a sense, as a cultural group, we're transitioning on to the next life. So it's kind of interesting to feel that transition in the culture as well.
Yes, there's definitely a sunset to twilight feeling for many North American students of the Urantia book. Thankfully, that's not everywhere in the world. Thankfully, in Latin America, we have noon and dawn also happening, and that's where there seems to be a lot of growth. Deservedly mentioned, the Philippines should be mentioned because the book is gaining a foothold there, all over the Philippines. And I think it's very important to know that the book is decentralized, that the book is spreading in various languages and cultures throughout the world. Spanish is probably where it is spreading the fastest these days, but there are 22 at least, maybe 24 by now, translations, and not to mention multiple translations in some languages. And the teachings are spreading. And as someone who has had the opportunity to study, not very much in Spanish, but I had the privilege 10 years ago of being able to study with Gaetan Chalon and Lynn Saint-Pierre in Saint-Sophie in Quebec, in their French language study group there. And I also study with Diane Labrec in her group in Montreal as well, but more often weekly with Gaetan and Lynn. And I'm here to tell you the revelation is received as well in other languages where it has been translated as it is in English. The truths speak to people in any language, and it's so important. It's so important that we understand that, especially when in paper 52, section 6, we're told that one of the ways that we can further the social brotherhood before the full spiritual brotherhood takes hold on this planet, you know, and sisterhood. You know, I always have to say that today because brotherhood, while it used to be a little more non-gendered at one time, it seems to be more gendered these days. But we want our siblinghood to spread. And my point being that it takes hold wherever, in whatever language and wherever people are studying it. And we can be very, very thankful for that. I'm privileged to be able to see, have a front row seat to view some of that in the International Fellowship Committee where I serve. So,
yeah, I've been thinking the last little while. There's a passage in the section on the angelic government, a couple of passages, and I'll just share a couple of short paragraphs if that's okay, about sort of how the work of a particular generation fits. They use the word mosaic, into the mosaic of the unfolding of the ages, and it's, I've been thinking a lot as our cohort starts to make its transition to the mansion worlds. I've just been thinking a lot about how the work of our generation, which is reaching a culmination, has moved in the Urantia movement, has made its contribution, and I think the translation of the book into languages and the pushing of small groups of dedicated readers in different linguistic groups, and we of English readers are still, relatively speaking, a small group. How it fits into this succession of things as they're developing on our world. And so this is paragraphs 114, paper 114, 6, 5, and 6, 6. It describes two core of angels. The first is the epical angels, and they say these are the angels of the current age, the dispensational group. These celestial ministers are entrusted with the oversight and direction of the affairs of each generation as they are designed to fit into the mosaic of the age in which they occur. That's fascinating language. The present core of epical angels serving on Urantia is the third group assigned to the planet during the current dispensation. And then they must work pretty closely with the next group, which are called the progress angels. And they say these seraphim are entrusted with the task of initiating the evolutionary progress of the successive social ages. They foster the development of the inherent progressive trend of evolutionary creatures. They labor incessantly to make things what they ought to be. Now on duty as a second to be assigned to the planet. So I've been thinking a lot, you know, as we sort of reach this stage in the movement, about how the affairs of our generation are designed to fit into the mosaic of the larger age, let's say maybe conjecturally the next 1,000 years, you know, the last 100, the next 800-900 years, so sort of the age of the dawning of the fifth epical revelation. And, you know, I think we've done a lot of work. And I think, you know, there are probably ways in which we could have done more, but I don't think we've done a shoddy job, and I think sort of we're in the place of handing the baton on to the upcoming generation. So just been thinking about that a lot as people pass on.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, thank you for mentioning all of that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was a little distracted from the point that I was making earlier, and you made some very good ones there, Marvin. I wanted to point out that one of the things that we could do better with is practicing some of this, you know, furthering the social brotherhood, where they talk on 5263 about social fraternity, the multiplication of international and interracial social contacts and fraternal organizations through travel, commerce, and competitive play. Well, we've been doing that mm-hmm. as a planet. Development of a common language. We haven't been doing that so well, though English is somewhat of a lingua franca in the world. But multiplication of multilinguists, this seems to be very, very important, and it's something it seems that we could take on as a Urantian culture, and by that I mean a big U Urantian, anyone who's an adherent of the book and a reader believer of the teachings could always work on that. Not everybody has a facility for language, you know, a second language, the same as everybody else, but many more of us do that have not bothered. And I was actually watching some videos yesterday that were interesting about how the Defense Department teaches language, you know, ramps people up very, very quickly. And the Mormon Church, how they do so with their missions and how they immerse them. It's almost sink or swim. And some, it's not that way. There's support, but it's wow, you're thrown into the deep end and immersed in languages. And it seems like we could do better with that as a Urantian culture in terms of expanding our contacts in the world. One of the things that really isn't known in the Anglophone readership, by and large, is how much and how well the book is spreading in other cultures and other languages. And let me just share with you, you know, if you go to the Urantia.org site, the foundation site, you can see right at the top there, it's in different languages, but basically the book is in English, it's in Spanish in three different translations: Portuguese, Polish, Russian, French, Romanian, Hungarian, German, Ukrainian, Italian, Korean, Dutch, Arabic, Finnish, Greek, Swedish, Hebrew, Estonian, Lithuanian, Farsi, Chinese, at least simplified Chinese. I'm not sure if that's a Mandarin translation or not. I apologize. I don't know what Czechtina is. It might be Czech, but I wouldn't swear on that. I can't remember what that is. Danish, Indonesian, Bahasa Indonesian, and Turkish. Now, that's wonderful that we have that kind of reach, and we know some of the people that have actually spread the teachings, to people through those languages. And we know that the history, I mean, the Dutch translation was one of the first. The French was probably the first, with Jacques Weiss doing his Cosmogonie du Livre Ancien. We're an international movement, and we hardly realize it. And it's mainly because we're spread thin. But we're spread thin, and we're all. But it's a quality thinness. It may be a veneer so far in various cultures, but it's a very potent veneer.
Wow.
There's something I just talking about the Master Seraphim. You know, these 12 groups. And Andre, Marvin, you're reading that from a couple of them there. And it just occurred to me how the 12 groups of angels, not exactly, but in a way they parallel the schools of Dalmatia and perhaps also the schools of the Garden of Eden. Not exactly, but if you look at the list, you know, there's definitely some strong parallels. So it occurs to me that, I mean, the 12 groups of Master Seraphim, that was instituted after Pentecost, as I recall. You know, it's kind of a workaround. And I'm kind of seeing that as almost like a, I don't know if substitute's the right word, but it's an attempt to pick up the thread on what was lost in both Dalmatia and the Garden in terms of an organized approach to the uplift of the culture on the planet, you know, with these multiple focuses on development. And it just always strikes me when I read about this Master Seraphim, it's like, how are they doing this? Because with Dalmatia in the Garden, you know, there were visible, you know, there were teachers on the ground, you know, that were assigned to teach those, you know, in those different schools. And, you know, we have Nod, of course, and Dan, and who are so well-remembered, and others, too. But it was an on-the-ground, visible instruction regime. And I'm just wondering if someday on this world we'll again have that. And in other words, if these 12 groups of Master Seraphim will sometime actually have brick and mortar manifestations of what they're trying to do, you know, kind of invisibly as best they can. And there's a, you know, of course, a long time period involved getting anything done on this planet under the circumstances because all of our superhuman help is invisible. Nobody even knows it's there. So I'm just wondering, well, I don't know if there's really a question in here or not. I just thought it was interesting to kind of see that, that parallel. But I do
I think it's got to be a question
whose
answer is yes.
Function. How they function.
I agree.
How they accomplish their mission. It's all kind of mysterious.
Yeah, that is mysterious. I agree. Go ahead, Pam. You were going to say something.
Oh no! I just agree with what he's saying.
Yeah.
There's always patterns just show up, you know, for a reason. So there's definitely a pattern there that could happen. And then Adam and Eve possibly coming back.
We don't know. They speculate about a number of different things. We know that they're members of the Council of 24, so they're already re-involved in moving Urantia forward, both on the Council of 24 and from time to time as Governor General. you know, the probability is about 5 and 6 at this point that both of them have been governors general. I'm going to guess that the probability is much higher that one of them has been governor general already. Mm-hmm. There's only 4 of the council of 24 that have not been governor general, and we switch from the 20th to the 21st, right around May 18th, 2030, coming right up in just 7 years from now, a little less than 7 years. So that we'll have the changing of the guard. Oh, if we could only see that changing of the guard.
Yes.
Wouldn't that be something? Yeah.
Well, interestingly, I mean, people have suggested, and I think it's an interesting suggestion, the idea of, you know, surveying the 12 groups of angels and maybe picking one, you know, for oneself. You know, you feel like, well, I could volunteer to help with that somehow.
Exactly. Right.
And even though it isn't just call them up on the phone or send them an email kind of thing, you know, we don't have those means of direct communication, yet we can still focus on those purposes. And, you know, any individual could do that with any one of those groups of angels. It's like, yeah,
absolutely.
I like that project. I want to be part of that somehow. And then, you know, just open yourself up to that possibility. And there are ways. I mean, all the ways that the angels have of working, you know, all the way down to our, you know, guardian ministers and all of that. You know, they have their ways. So as time, you know, as events unfold, we can definitely contribute.
Absolutely.
So I think that's an interesting approach to, like, okay, I want to be of service. What can I do? I'm volunteering. Got my hand up.
Yeah.
And
it's not
that's an avenue conceptually of how to find a path into service is to survey the 12 groups.
Wall. You know, there's no wall between us and them. You know, it's an open universe. And they want us to participate. They want to communicate.
Sure, of course.
I mean, and that's not just them. I mean, any of the beings, in reversion directions or whoever, you know, we are participating with them whether we know it or not, and we might as well be as conscious as possible about it, you know?
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, that's kind of the point, maybe.
Yeah.
If we have this information, this is revealed information.
Yeah,
and it
exactly.
has power that's only we're only beginning to really fathom, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we should give a shout out to those that have already promoted that idea, and one of those is Neil Waldrop, who promoted the idea of the unceasing endeavor of the Master Seraphim. You can go to his site, which is globalendeavor.net. I'm looking that up now, and he has a number of interesting things there on his site, but the one who has promoted it in exactly the way that you have talked about, he calls it the unceasing campaign of the Master Seraphim. But the one who has talked about it, and in fact what we did is we hosted a 7-week series that the Global Endeavor did back in 2017 here in the Cosmic Citizen space. You can find those webcasts in our archive on the blogtalkradio.com/cosmiccitizen page and go to the archive there. But I want to give a shout out to Robin Liske, otherwise known as Rosie Liske, who also put together a website that fostered this idea that you could sign up to be on a particular thing, a particular Master Seraphim's campaign, let's say. And the idea was not that you're signing up on their campaign directly. There's no woo-woo here. It was a matter of coordinating people that may have interest in health, industry, reversion, meaning you know, humor and all of that and entertainment or you name it, education, all of these things that are covered by the Master Seraphim, and coordinating some of your work with people that are like-minded. And I'll look for that site as well. I don't drop that in, but nice. Big shout out to Rosie Liske for having gotten people thinking about that. And while I don't know how much traction it has, it's a wonderful idea, and it's an idea that may be ahead of its time, but we can act on it at any time. So I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yes, thank you for that, Andre. That's good stuff.
Well, yeah. All right. I mean, it's, here we are on our DIY planet once again. You know, it requires
yes.
a lot of initiative. It requires a lot of initiative on the from the human level to make that reach. You know, it takes faith, it
mm-hmm.
takes belief,
yeah,
takes enthusiasm
right.
about the potentials. It takes a lot of factors to make that reach into the invisible.
right.
But it's real, though. That's the thing about it. You begin to get a sense of the reality of these things. Even though we can't see them, they're nonetheless real. Certainly the
mm-hmm.
values involved and the priorities involved and the future possibilities, all that, you know, very real. So it's an interesting situation we have here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
so, you know,
so wonderful. Go ahead. Go ahead, Marvin.
Yeah, it's I mean, one of the things that characterizes the very peculiar state of our world is that on any normal world, we would have physical representatives of the celestial administration on the world.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, celestial leadership. And just looking at a couple of paragraphs, it's 93, 10, 6, and 7. It just related to the thought you were bringing up, Chuck, of, you know, I wonder, I mean, I have to believe, well, I don't have to believe, I tend to believe that there will again be a time on our world where we will have celestial presences visibly manifest and working
mm-hmm.
in the leadership of our planetary culture. Because it's
mm-hmm.
hard to see how we're going to get to where the ages of light and life. I mean, there has to be a resumption of the normal succession of epical revelations with celestial persons like the Trinity Teacher Sons and the Magisterial Sons, you know, and
mm-hmm.
and some presence from the planetary prince and Adamic regimes. So here are a couple of paragraphs. And speaking of Machiavelli to Melchizedek, as his was an emergency bestowal on Urantia, it does not appear from the records what Machiavelli's future may be. It may develop that the Melchizedek corps of Nebadon have sustained the permanent loss of one of their numbers. I would just skip ahead. If our conjectures in this respect are correct, it is altogether possible that Machiavelli Melchizedek may again appear in person on Urantia
mm-hmm.
and in some
mm-hmm.
modified manner resume the role of the dethroned planetary prince.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's open mm-hmm. to conjecture where he would be visibly present, or else appear on Earth to function as the vicegerent planetary prince representing Christ Michael, who now actually holds the title of planetary prince of Urantia. While it is far from clear to us what Machiavelli's destiny may be, nevertheless, events which have so recently taken place strongly suggest that the foregoing conjectures are probably not far from the truth. You wonder what events they're referring to. Could be the advent of this revelation that we're part of. And then they go on to say, we well understand how by his triumph on Urantia, Michael became the successor of both Caligastia and Adam, how he became the planetary prince of peace and the second Adam. And now we behold the conferring upon this Melchizedek of the title Vicegerent Planetary Prince of Urantia. will he also be constituted the vice chair and material son of your rancho? Or is there a possibility that an unexpected and unprecedented event is to take place, the sometime return to the planet of Adam and Eve, or certain of their progeny as representatives of Michael, with the titles vice chairs of the second Adam of Urantia? And I couldn't find it quickly, but there's another place where they conjecture that there may come a time when Michael and Macavento Melchizedek and the progeny of Adam and Eve may be on the planet all at the same time. And so, you know, I mean, the hope here is the reestablishment of some of these centers of celestial leadership in our civilization.
Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Any day or hour, any day or hour quote is in 114:14. Maybe that's what you're thinking of there. I mean, when I read I almost get goosebumps.
Yeah, what do they say?
Can you read? That's paper 114:14. They say, some believe that Macavena will not come to take personal direction of Urantian affairs until the end of the current dispensation. Others hold that the vicegerent prince, referring to Macaventa, may not come as such until Michael sometime returns to Urantia, as he promised, still in the flesh. So others, including this narrator, look for Macaventa's appearance any day or hour. And that would be visible. I mean, if he steps into that role as vicegerent planetary prince, I mean, he's going to bring a whole administration with him, and that's going to be visible. I mean, I don't see any how it could not be. You know, Melchizedek can do that. They can make themselves visible at will, right? We know that about them. I don't know. It's just one of those things that could happen.
Well, I just found... Yeah, that's a good one. I just found the passage I was actually thinking of, which is even more explicit, but it's all speculation. It's 93:10-8, and they say all these speculations associated with the certainty of future appearances of both magisterial and Trinity teacher sons, in conjunction with the explicit promise of the Creator Son to return sometime, make Urantia a planet of future uncertainty and render it one of the most interesting and intriguing spheres in all the universe of Nebadon. It is altogether possible that in some future age, when Urantia is approaching the era of light and life, so this is way out ahead from where we are, after the affairs of the Lucifer Rebellion and the Caligastia Secession have been finally adjudicated, we may witness the presence on Urantia simultaneously of Macaventa, Adam, Eve, and Christ Michael, as well as either a magisterial son or even Trinity teacher sons. So, I mean, this is speculation, but... Mm-hmm. You know, when you think about our current planetary situation and the degree of crises that we find ourselves in, I think it's going to take quite a bit of intervention as the ages unfold to get us back to a place where we have that kind of celestial leadership as part of our planetary culture. And something along those lines has to happen. I don't think we're going to do it all by ourselves.
No.
Well, we're not, even now.
No.
I mean, we have
even now.
We have thought adjusters. We have the spirit of truth. I mean, so much has been given already, apart from visible presence. We don't have that. But who knows when that could happen. I mean, the thing about any day or any hour, I mean, that's exciting to me because it could be any day or any hour, you know, as opposed to way off in the future. But who knows? And then there's the magisterial son idea, too. But I've often wondered if maybe if and when these things happen, which may not be anytime soon, but when they do, something like this happens, like a Macavena steps into the role of vicegerent planetary prince, that the Urantia book would serve as a textbook for an organized school that has superhuman administration. And that's kind of a cool thought, too. You know, that we have the book now, but maybe it's actually intended to be used as part of some kind of a school that's going to be organized, either by Magavena or Magisterial Fund or something like that. Mm-hmm. It's hard to imagine that, given the world's current conditions. But
you know what, I think, Chuck, is in a sort of a parallel to Van and Amadon sort of holding down a cultural fort, in a sense, in preparation for the arrival of Adam and Eve. You know,
in other words, there had to,
for a very long time, but that was a different age when things developed much, much more slowly. Things are developing very quickly because of our technology. And I think there's a parallel there. I think at some future time, part of the purpose of this revelation is to prepare a cohort of you know, to some degree, universe-conscious human beings who are aware enough of the context that when there is a celestial appearance and a reestablishment of some kind of leadership in our world of these celestial beings, either Melchizedek or, you know, the equivalent of a planetary prince in an Adamic regime, that there's a group of people who have enough understanding so that it doesn't cause simply mass confusion and mayhem, but there's a group of human beings that can, in a sense, work together with them because they're aware of who they are and how it all fits.
Yeah,
so,
like there's a preparation. It's like we're in a preparation phase for something.
To me, it's foreseeable that a 1,000-year period would offer enough time for, let's say, a cohort of 10,000, 20,000 globally, 40, 50,000, whatever, solid Urantia book reading students to work globally in conjunction with celestial personalities. That's conceivable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so too. I guess
wonderful.
We'll see, or we'll hear about it on the news.
We will. We will. Well, and you know, what's interesting is all of this is happening post-Pentecost. The pouring out of the Spirit of Truth happened then. That changed everything. You can imagine, thank you for bringing up the Master Seraphim, Marvin. You can imagine that all this, I need to be about my Father's business, you know, talks that he had when he was with his apostles were helping to set these things up and saying, you know, talking with, you know, Gabriel and his, you know, chief lieutenants, you know, how best should we set this all up? And this is what they came up with, were, you know, the governor's general. He knew that already about the governor's general by the time that John was in prison, which is one of the reasons he didn't act on John. He wanted John to die before the end of the dispensation so he could take part in that and be on the Council of 24 and be a resident governor general and all of that. And so, you know, you think about all of those kinds of things. And my point is in getting that, it led to the universal bestowal of thought adjusters, which, of course, all come from the Father, however directly or indirectly. And we're talking about the Father today. And we're on paper five.
Oh,
and his relation to the individual. Oh, my goodness.
Oh my goodness.
We could actually read about that in the service of this. This is a wonderful discussion.
I've got something though that I want to throw into that.
Oh, come on! You dragged us back.
It relates directly to the opening paragraph. So
go ahead.
In the opening paragraph, paper five, they mention thought adjusters, and it's not the first time that phrase comes up or that term comes up, but it's one of the first times.
Yes.
And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but that term, thought adjuster, always kind of was a little like, what to do with that? Feels a little I don't know, off-putting or whatever. I know it is for some people.
I agree.
And there's this place where they explain that. So I just thought this would lead in an interesting way. And this is in paper 108. I'm sure you're all familiar with this, but this is in paper 108.57. This is a solitary messenger speaking, saying, "I doubt that I am able to explain to you just what the adjusters do in your minds and for your souls. I do not know that I am fully cognizant of what is really going on in the cosmic association of a divine monitor and a human mind. It is all somewhat of a mystery to us, not as to the plan and purpose, but as to the actual mode of accomplishment. And this is just why we are confronted with such difficulty in finding an appropriate name for these supernal gifts to mortal man, to mortal men and women." That's a really interesting kind of little side note there, I think. That they actually had trouble. They had difficulty finding a name for the adjusters, what to call them. Mm-hmm. I mean, they call them, you know, you could call it the inner spirit or the spirit of God, you know, the God within, or, you know, there's just other terms.
Mystery
that can be
monitors.
Used.
Mystery monitor.
But
yeah.
They've chosen to mostly use the term thought adjuster, I think, for good reasons, because it points to their function in a way that's probably more accurate than any of those other terms.
Yeah.
But yet, at the same time, it leaves us with this kind of feeling like, my thoughts are
control.
Being adjusted.
Yeah, yes.
Right. Yeah, I don't know.
Well, I mean, they had to somehow call them something that was meaningful, and they may as well relate it to the function that these fragments of God are having, since they're absolute, practically undifferentiated. And so that's what they do. So I am going to insist that we read.
Okay.
Read now.
So with that caveat.
I don't know, Andre, we could have a historic first, you know, where we have an entire program and never get to our assigned reading. That would
I'm afraid to say I don't think that would be a first necessarily. We may have done that once already.
Paula would come back and say, "You were so bad, you guys, without me."
I agree. Yeah. Of course it is. So who would like to read at least the first two paragraphs? And I would suggest that we get into the approach to God very shortly after that. Let's look at what that two paragraph intro is. Who'd like to read that?
Go ahead. Why don't you read it?
Pam. I think Pam, it would be good. Pam, do you want to read
it?
We haven't.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah.
All
go
right.
For it.
All right. Excuse me. All right. Paper 5. God's relation to the individual. If the finite mind of man is unable to comprehend how so great and so majestic a God as the Universal Father can descend from his eternal abode in infinite perfection to fraternize with the individual human creature, then must such a finite intellect rest assurance of divine fellowship upon the truth of the fact that an actual fragment of the living God resides within the intellect of every normal-minded and morally conscious Urantia mortal. The indwelling thought adjusters are a part of the eternal deity of the Paradise Father. Man does not have to go farther than his own inner experience of the soul's contemplation of this spiritual reality presence to find God and attempt communion with him. God has distributed the infinity of his eternal nature throughout the existential realities of his six absolute coordinates, but he may at any time make direct personal contact with any part or phase or kind of creation through the agency of his prepersonal fragments. And the eternal God has also reserved to himself the prerogative of bestowing personality upon the divine creators and the living creatures of the universe of universes, while he has further reserved the prerogative of maintaining direct and parental contact with all these personal beings through the personality circuit.
Well, very good. Thank you very much, Pam.
Sure.
So isn't that a remarkable juxtaposition in speaking of the infinite God? He's distributed the infinity of his eternal nature through the existential realities of his six absolute coordinates, which we can also read as infinite, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And yet, through the agency of his prepersonal fragments, he can make contact with the finite individually, each one of us, in these fragments of himself indwelling us prepersonally, not to mention including us, little mortal beings, tiny zygotic spirits, in the personality circuit. What do you all think about that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think they're complimental.
This is why he is God.
Yeah. It's why,
well, you know,
it's
why
he's
why
God.
He's
yes,
God.
Absolutely.
You know, I think it's actually a pretty radical idea. You know, I mean, it does find expression in some of the human religious traditions, particularly, I think, and I'm not a great student of comparative religion, but I think of the Atman in the Hindu tradition is, I think, one of the earliest examples of the idea of an indwelling presence of the divine. But it's a radical idea that our relationship to God is based on the fact that God is actually inside of us. And it's such an intimate phenomenon that it's in the deepest place inside of us. That's a very, very powerful concept. Because it says we have that relationship available all the time in the most intimate interior place inside of us, which is, that's very powerful. And there are a lot of religions that don't have that, and most people don't have that. They have a sense of God far away and the controller of everything. But most people, when you talk to them about the idea of God's presence deeply within us and that we can have that intimate relationship, I think that's revelatory for them, and it's mm-hmm. powerful. I think it provides solace, because if what you realize is that it's from within that God's love is pouring into us and nurturing us and nourishing us, that's what people are hungry for, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and it's also a major challenge. It's a major challenge to accept that.
Mm-hmm.
Because if that's the case, then it means it requires some kind of action or participation. You know, for those that are, this is a new concept too. It's like, that means something's demanded of me now. In other words, you know, the searchlight is seeing my soul and seeing exactly who I am. And I mean, you know, worthiness and all of that stuff can get, you know, foggy in the midst of all that. But it creates a need to recognize and begin to participate and come out of our individual isolation in a way.
Yeah, I like what you're saying. There's kind of an accountability there. It's sort of like we have a hall monitor, but it's not a hall monitor, it's a mystery monitor.
Hall monitor, yeah.
Yeah, that's funny. Monitoring the byways of our minds. Anyway, but yeah, no, it is so personal and so intimate. And at the same time, we have this revealed concept of the personality circuit, which, you know, mm-hmm. doesn't quite get as much emphasis, but I think it's in some ways just as important, because that's a personality relationship as opposed to a pre-personal relationship. So I think the two are intended to be complemental, that we can always, God will always hear our thoughts. He's, you know, through the personality circuit. So we can always communicate directly with the Father over the personality circuit. And you know, I've probably brought this up too much already, but in the 1930s dictionary, the definition of circuit that I think is applicable is a system of what they call a system of two-way communication between two places.
Mm.
So when they use the word circuit, I think that's what they mean. So we inherent in the soul of personality is this communication connectivity to the source of the personality. That's part of the gift of personality is this connection back to its source over the personality circuit.
Right.
And that, interestingly, I think, complements the idea of the indwelling fragment of the same God in a pre-personal function. So there's this, it creates almost like a divinity tension or something. It's like the God within is reaching for the God that's on the outside, in a sense. And we're the ones who have the opportunity to flip that switch or make that connection or however you want to put that.
Well, how about putting it?
Relation.
How about putting it as? Yeah, exactly, Pam. You know, God is lovingly in touch with us in more than one way.
Mm-hmm.
Probably even more than two ways. And so, So that would be that would be the main upshot of this. And what's interesting about what Marvin had been talking about as well was this idea of how in human philosophy transcendence seems to preclude immanence in some people's minds, and the immanence of God seems to preclude God's transcendence, and they have trouble conceiving of both the personality of God and the identity of God on the in another dimension. And so that's very interesting about the Urantia book is the Urantia book says no, you hold both those ideas in your mind. It may be it may be incomprehensible, but it's you can faith realize that God is able to do that, and that God is you in multiple ways, and God is never outside of touch with you. Go ahead, Marvin.
Right.
Well, actually, for me, it's interesting you say that, Andre. I think you're right. For me, one of the most powerful sort of combined revelatory ideas in the Urantia book that I can actually feel, it's almost like it's a visceral experience of going outside and looking up at the starry realms or looking at nature and feeling the transcendence of God, how huge God is to have made everything in creation. And at the same time, hold in my heart and in my mind that same presence is somehow in the deepest place inside of me and destined to be one with me. That is astonishing. And it's very, for me, it's an extremely powerful experience to feel those two poles of God's nature, God's transcendence and God's immanence. And to feel them at the same time, that it's the same presence controlling everything and yet in the deepest place inside of us.
Mm-hmm.
One of my favorite sentences in the text is from the lesson in self-mastery, which picks up and sort of resonates with this theme that we're speaking of. It says, your secret of the mastery of self is bound up with your faith in the indwelling spirit, which ever works by love. That's a really interesting thing, to actually have faith in particular in the immanence of God's presence, in the indwelling spirit, and that it is from that inner place that God's love is pouring into us.
Mm-hmm.
That's very powerful, I think.
It is. It is.
Yeah. Whenever I think of immanence and transcendence, I naturally think, well, there must be a triad here, because there always is.
Yes.
And I think the third part goes with that is the associative nature of deity, and they do talk about that somewhat earlier in the book. So I think the presence of God is immanent, transcendent, and also it's also associative, which is like adds a really interesting dimension to that. So if you think about Jesus, you know, who's been human, he's been one of us, and he can be part of our lives even now. He's still human, even as he now is, they say. That, to me, is very associative. You know, the adjuster is kind of transcendent. You know, it's what I'm reaching for. It's beyond me. And the presence of the Mother Spirit is more imminent. You know, it's all-pervading, comes from the all-pervading presence of the Infinite Spirit. But this notion of the Son being associative really, I think, completes that threefold endowment of Spirit that they always talk about, you know, that we've been gifted with. And that's kind of missing, I think, from most evolutionary religions, is the idea that God can be all three simultaneously. And
well,
each one has an important piece in the, our overall relationship.
I think you're right on that, Chuck. And I think the associative is, to me, indelibly associated with God the Supreme.
Who they describe
as our mother, right? She is the embodiment of all of our associations as they are unfolding and evolving. She's the summation of that. She is the divine family as it associatively as it's unfolding. So I think you're right on target. God is immanent, God is transcendent, and God is associative in this universe age is really encompassing.
And that's the that is the essence of the Trinity. So it's like, and it becomes sevenfold beyond that, you know, through the Spirit, you know, oh my goodness, the triunities, whatever. You know, the whole subject of Trinity is really hitting me, having just seen the movie on Oppenheimer, and the name of the first bomb testing he gave was Trinity, and it's really a fascinating story, the movie, and even MSNBC has done a really nice abbreviated overview of Oppenheimer. But and then today I sent out to Socketman an article from my friend who's talking about the Trinity nature that was like behind, in other words, the complicated story that Oppenheimer was involved in. And so the topic of Trinity was very much a part of Mike Morrell's article. And so it's really an important, in fact, I had fun reading some phrases under the Trinity portion of the Urantia papers. Just, you know, and you're right, you know, Chuck, it's the associative nature of Trinity that really creates a reality for us. You know, we get to experience the personal and the physical and the mental and the, you know, the wholeness of God comes through that whole relational thing of Trinity. So, I mean, it's just a wonderful topic to explore, and I'm glad we kind of hit on it today.
Yeah,
for sure.
Well, what a wonderful discussion.
I can't go past that. I mean, that emphasis without mentioning the power of the symbolism of spiritual family relationships, because that's what the Trinity is.
Mm-hmm.
It's the original expression of the relationships of parent to child. And in a certain sense, the parent-child relationship is both immanent and transcendent. I mean, the parent is outside of the child and has an exterior relationship to the child, and the parent is somehow reproduced within the child, you know? So it's both transcendent and immanent. And then the parent, you know, the father and the son co-create the spirit. And so you have the completion of the associative relationships between parent, child, and fraternal brother-sister relationships. Mm-hmm. And that's the model for all of personal reality. It's the model for all of what's going on in the cosmos. And the whole purpose of the creation is immanent, transcendent, and associative. So I think this is a really interesting conversation, and it's all embedded in spiritual family relationships.
There's
so in furthering this conversation, what I'd like to do
is let's read the approach to God, because here we have, in talking about the family, we have a simple way of taking and making humanly understandable how three infinities are related to each other. They are family. Mm. And that, in fact, what it does is it makes God approachable to us. It makes the infinite Father approachable to all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Let's read about that and talk about it on the other side. Who'd like to read the approach to God? See how I did that?
I can take the first few paragraphs anyways. Well, it's not that long a section.
It's not a long section. Okay, it's 12 paragraphs. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'll launch into it. The approach to God. The inability of the finite creature to approach the infinite Father is inherent not in the Father's aloofness, but in the finiteness and material limitations of created beings. The magnitude of the spiritual difference between the highest personality of universe existence and the lower groups of created intelligences is inconceivable. Were it possible for the lower orders of intelligence to be transported instantly into the presence of the Father himself, they would not know they were there. They would there be just as oblivious to the presence of the universal Father as where they now are. There is a long, long road ahead of mortal man before he can consistently and within the realms of possibility ask for safe conduct into the paradise presence of the universal Father. Spiritually, man must be translated many times before he can attain a plane that will yield the spiritual vision, which will enable him to see even any one of the seven master spirits. Our Father is not in hiding. He is not in arbitrary seclusion. He has mobilized the resources of divine wisdom in a never-ending effort to reveal himself to the children of his universal domains. There is an infinite grandeur and an inexpressible generosity connected with the majesty of his love, which causes him to yearn for the association of every created being who can comprehend, love, or approach him. And it is therefore the limitations inherent in you, inseparable from your finite personality and material existence, that determine the time and place and circumstances in which you may achieve the goal of the journey of mortal ascension and stand in the presence of the Father at the center of all things. Although the approach to the paradise presence of the Father must await your attainment of the highest finite levels of spirit progression, you should rejoice in the recognition of the ever-present possibility of immediate communion with the bestowal spirit of the Father so intimately associated with your inner soul and your spiritualizing self. Although the approach to the paradise presence of the Father must await your attainment of the highest finite levels of spirit progression, you should rejoice in the recognition of the ever-present possibility of immediate communion with the bestowal spirit of the Father so intimately associated with your inner soul and your spiritualizing self. The mortals of the realms of time and space may differ greatly in innate abilities and intellectual endowment. They may enjoy environments exceptionally favorable to social advancement and moral progress, or they may suffer from the lack of almost every human aid to culture and supposed advancement in the arts of civilization. But the possibilities for spiritual progress in the ascension career are equal to all. increasing levels of spiritual insight and cosmic meanings are attained quite independently of all such socio-moral differentials of the diversified material environments on the evolutionary worlds. However, your intermortals may differ in their intellectual, social, economic, and even moral opportunities and endowments, forget not that their spiritual endowment is uniform and unique. That's an interesting combination. Spiritual endowment is uniform and unique. They all enjoy the same divine presence of the gift from the Father, and they are all equally privileged to seek intimate personal communion with this indwelling spirit of divine origin. While they may all equally choose to accept the uniform spiritual leading of these mystery monitors. If mortal man is wholeheartedly spiritually motivated, unreservedly consecrated to the doing of the Father's will, then since he is so certainly and so effectively spiritually endowed by the indwelling and divine adjuster, there cannot fail to materialize in that individual's experience the sublime consciousness of knowing God and the supernal assurance of surviving for the purpose of finding God by the progressive experience of becoming more and more like him. Man is spiritually indwelt by a surviving thought adjuster. If such a human mind is sincerely and spiritually motivated, if such a human soul desires to know God and become like him, honestly wants to do the Father's will, there exists no negative influence of mortal deprivation, nor positive power of possible interference, which can prevent such a divinely motivated soul from securely ascending to the portals of paradise. The Father desires all of his creatures to be in personal communion with him. He has on paradise a place to receive all those whose survival status and spiritual nature make possible such attainment. Therefore, settle in your philosophy now and forever. To each of you and to all of us, God is approachable. The Father is attainable. The way is open. The forces of divine love and the ways and means of divine administration are all interlocked in an effort to facilitate the advancement of every worthy intelligence of every universe to the paradise presence of the Universal Father. The fact that vast time is involved in the attainment of God makes the presence and personality of the infinite nonetheless real. Your ascension is a part of the circuit of the seven super universes. And though you swing around it countless times, you may expect in spirit and in status to be ever swinging inward. You can depend upon being translated from sphere to sphere, from the outer circuits ever nearer the inner center, and someday, doubt not, you shall stand in the divine and central presence and see him, figuratively speaking, face to face. It is a question of the attainment of actual and literal spiritual levels, and these spiritual levels are attainable by any being been indwelt by a mystery monitor and who has subsequently eternally fused with that thought adjuster. The Father is not in spiritual hiding, but so many of his creatures have hidden themselves away in the mists of their own willful decisions. and for the time being have separated themselves from the communion of his spirit and the spirit of his son by the choosing of their own perverse ways and by the indulgence of the self-assertiveness of their intolerant minds and unspiritual natures. Mortal man may draw near God and may repeatedly forsake the divine will so long as the power of choice remains. Man's final doom is not sealed until he has lost the power to choose the Father's will. There is never a closure of the Father's heart to the need and the petition of his children. Only do his offspring close their hearts forever to the Father's drawing power when they finally and forever lose the desire to do his divine will, to know him, and to be like him. Likewise is man's eternal destiny assured when a juster fusion proclaims to the universe that such an ascender has made the final and irrevocable choice to live the Father's will. The great God makes direct contact with mortal man and gives a part of his infinite and eternal and incomprehensible self to live and dwell within him. God has embarked upon the eternal adventure with man. If you yield to the leadings of the spiritual forces in you and around you, you cannot fail to attain the high destiny established by a loving God as the universal goal of his ascendant creatures from the evolutionary worlds of space.
Thank you very much, Marvin, for that wonderful reading.
Wow. You know, what an amazing section.
Yes. You know, and it starts off by, you know, approaching us where we are, that the human condition is such that, you know, we can't see God. We can't even necessarily feel God or whatever in many people's experience. We don't get a lot of, quote unquote, proof that God is there. And there's some explanation for that. There's some explanation for the distance that is part of our traversal. And it's not just physical distance. It's this ascension through various spiritual levels and what will be necessary to man must be translated many times before he can attain a plane that will yield to spiritual vision, which will enable him to see, they don't say God, they say even any one of the seven master spirits, high spiritual beings, but sub-absolute in comparison to God. That's a very, very interesting comparison. And one of the best analogies I have for this is an experience I had at the Grand Canyon that I think I've shared on the broadcast years ago from time to time. But it was simply watching a helicopter tour down the middle of the Grand Canyon, or, you know, what I thought really was on the outer edge of the Grand Canyon, the other side, the north side of the Grand Canyon, looking from the south. And every time that helicopter got to a side canyon, it looked to me like that helicopter was going down that canyon. But no, it was in front. And again, my mind would be fooled. I would look at it, and there's another side canyon. And again, I would think it was going down that side canyon. But no, it was still in front. My mind was incapable of judging the actual distance that spanned the Grand Canyon to actually fathom that. And so what's interesting here is they're telling us this, Only we can imagine this is Grand Canyon multiplied in terms of what we have yet to go through in order to achieve what it will be to be in direct touch with the Father. And yet, the Father has reached out to us. So, other thoughts on this?
Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that. Thank you, Andre. Mm.
Well, this section makes one of the clearest statements in the book, I think, about how we approach this matter of knowing God. Like in the sixth paragraph, the last sentence, they say that we find God by the progressive experience of becoming more and more like him. Mm. So we don't find God by evolving our theories of theology, you know, or whatever, any other, you know, maybe those things are important in their own way, but we really find God by becoming more like him. And yeah. That's a transformation of ourselves to become more like God. And then they make clear in the next sentence, in the next paragraph, that this is done by honestly desiring to do the Father's will. So they say in paragraph 7, if such a human soul desires to know God and become like him, honestly wants to do the Father's will. So they're creating an equivalence there. I think that's very important. That explains why the desire to do the Father's will is so important. It isn't just, you know, because of some slavish thing we have to do. It's our way of knowing God by becoming more like him.
Yeah.
And when I see that, then I have a whole new appreciation for the concept of doing the Father's will and why that's so important, because there's no other way to know him. And it's this pathway to knowing him involves a transformation in ourselves where we become more like him, and that's how we know him. You know, it's not by doing some external magic trick or miraculous this or that or hearing voices or who knows what. It's really a self-transformation in this direction of becoming more like God. That's how we know him.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I think that's very helpful for me to have that clarity in those couple of paragraphs where they explain that.
Yes, me too. I agree with that. That jumped out at me also, Chuck, that to equivalate divine will with knowing and being like God. In other words, yes, the divine will is not some kind of precept. It's a personal personal action to know him and be like him. In other words, it puts it into an active category rather than just a mental construct. Yeah.
Well, and I want to kind of share a thought with you all and pose a question that for me is very relevant. And what you're saying, Chuck and Pam, for me really is a good entree to this question, because the issue for me is time frames. What kinds of time frames are we speaking of? And one of the things they make very, very clear is this transformative process where we become godlike is basically a near eternal process, right? It's going to be happening over unimaginably long periods of time as we ascend inward toward paradise. And the associated question for me around time frame is, what is the task here and now in front of us in this life? And when I think about that, I think about this life in association with the early mansion worlds. Let me sort of unpack it a little bit. I think on a sphere of light and life, the age span is 400 to 500 years, and many, many people at the later ages of light and life actually fuse. So so there's an extended period of time wherein we're supposed to make accomplish the territory that is supposed to happen in this initial life, and ideally it's a long life of some 400 to 500 years, and in our case it's a life that extends through this initial very short material existence into the early mansion worlds, the first seven mansion worlds, where we mature the choice that eventually results in fusion. And I want to just read a couple of things. In this section we just read, there's this statement, it's paragraph number 6. If mortal man is wholeheartedly spiritually motivated, unreservedly consecrated to doing of the Father's will, then since he is so certainly, etc. That's a very high bar. And I have wondered, have I attained that bar? And I have to say that I feel like I'm in the process of attaining it. And that to me fits with this passage that I've spent a lot of time thinking about, and I'd love to get you guys' thoughts on this. And this is the passage 112:7-6, and it's where they basically, I'll just read the whole passage and then reference it quickly. On the evolutionary world, selfhood is material. It's where they make the distinction between survival decisions being formulated here in this life, confirmed on the mansion worlds, and made, completed in fusion. So they say, on the evolutionary world, selfhood is material. It is a thing in the universe, and as such is subject to the laws of material existence. It is a fact in time and responsive to the vicissitudes thereof, which is all these differential equations in each of our natures and our situations, right, that they were talking about in this section we read. And then they say, survival decisions must here be formulated. So that's such an interesting term, and they italicize the word formulated. And then they go on to say, in the Marantia state, the self has become a new and more enduring universe reality. So that's on the mansion worlds. And its continuing growth is predicated on its increasing attunement to the mind and spirit circuits of the universes. Survival decisions are now being confirmed. And they italicize confirmed. And then they say, when the self attains the spiritual level, it has become a secure value in the universe, and this new value is predicated on the value that survival decisions have been made, which is italicized, which fact has been witnessed by eternal fusion with a thought adjuster. So I'm sorry, I'm taking a little while, but for me, there's an important question. Well, the way I've come to understand it is, I'm still in process of getting to the place where I'm wholeheartedly spiritually motivated and unreservedly consecrated to the doing of the Father's will. I'm still being baked, in a sense. In other words, my survival decisions here in this life, for the vast majority of us, are still being formulated, which is a crucial process. And it's in the mansion worlds, in those first mansion worlds, up until the fourth or fifth mansion world where we fuse, typically, where these decisions that we're formulating here will be fully confirmed. And for most of us, we reach that place of wholehearted spiritual motivation and unreserved consecration because we have everything we need in that environment to make that unreserved choice, which is what human beings on the spheres of light and life in a 400 or 500 year lifespan, they have all of that down here in this initial life. We have it on the mansion worlds. So, anyways, end of long story. I'd love to hear your thoughts on this stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's a wonderful thing to bring up because it really is talking about, you know, what some of our walk toward becoming one with God is. And I love the nuance in the wording, right? That survival decisions must be first formulated, then they're being confirmed in the Marantia life, and then they have been made. But look at those junctures. The now being confirmed is through that period of even fusing with the thought adjuster and is not over just because we have fused with the thought adjuster. We're still confirming those decisions, albeit it may be that we never would not confirm at that point, because that's what fusion indicates, is that we'll always now choose the right way. But that's that process is not finished until we make our transition from Arantia to spirit. That's when they say we are have made those decisions and we are now a secure value in the universe. That's what it takes. So there's different baking processes going on here. And if we were in part of that baking process, we would have Roman candled by now. Well, maybe not Roman candled, but we would have taken off in a chariot of fire, and we wouldn't be talking about you in the same way. Marvin, if I saw you go off in a chariot of fire, I would think differently about you. But that's the thing. The interesting thing is that God does think about us that way.
Mm-hmm.
God looks at us and knows we're going to make it, if only we want to.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we need to do is want to do it and be able and indicate that we truly want it by taking actions toward it. And if we do so, it's a done deal as far as God is concerned. Isn't that amazing?
Well, it's
interesting too, because here in the beginning it talks about how we are subject to the materiality of our existence, where we're responsive to the vicissitudes of materiality. We're bumping up against those vicissitudes. And then, as we move through this decision making and formulation and confirmation, even after all of that, this eternal fusion and all this at the end of that paragraph, we become liberated in potential. So we're just set free to be, on the path of potentiality. So, the never ending exploration of the highest universal value of God,
That's very interesting. Go ahead. Go ahead. Finish up, Pam, and I'll share that.
No, that's basically, even after all of that, accomplishment, we're more freely liberated for more potentiality, which is
the beginning.
It's the whole process is a potentiality reach.
and part of what's so fascinating to me is, there are three stages they're speaking of here: the stage of formulating a survival decision, the stage of confirming a final decision, survival decision, and the stage in which survival decisions are done, they're complete. And you're absolutely right, Andre and Pam. Then begins the true eternal ascent, which is an incredible journey of turning potentials into actuals. But what's so interesting to me is this initial stage where we formulate these decisions in our situation are made with a very – the formulation process is profoundly a stage of faith, because we do not have a direct manifestation of deity presence that is palpable and kind of unavoidable. As soon as we wake up on the mansion walls, and for this period of time between awakening on the mansion walls and fusion, we are in a state where they say we hear the voice of the adjuster directly, and there is communication between a divine presence and the emerging soul, and it's still dyadic. So we don't have that in this initial life. We do have it for that very short period of time of 4 to 5, 6 mansion worlds. And then they say, once fusion occurs, the need for communication as we understand it is no longer necessary, because we are of one mind in a sense. And then begins the eternal ascent. So what's fascinating to me is that these first two stages of formulating and confirming are so incredibly short compared to the stage, the third stage, that then unfolds into eternity and is never ending. And what it says to me is both this stage in this life, when we have to operate entirely by faith, and that 4 to 5 year, 4 to 5 mansion world experience where we have this precious direct relationship, but we haven't yet fused, are incredibly valuable periods of time and really very brief compared to what God has planned for us. And that's fascinating to me. And it makes me value what we have now and what we'll have on these early mansion worlds so much more fully.
It makes you realize the intensity of this first part and how it's designed to set direction, to firm up where we're going so that it doesn't ever go awry. It rarely goes awry with the celestial beings, but somehow if somebody goes awry, it can be pulled awry from all intents and purposes, it looks like, much more easily than it happens for us if we go through this kind of intense progression that we are scheduled to go through. So.
Yeah.
Well, there's a paragraph. Go ahead.
Well, go ahead, Pam, and then Chuck.
Well, I'm going to take it in another direction, but go ahead, Chuck.
Oh, okay. Well, just in this context, there's one paragraph that's always stood out for me where they really let us know that we can have some of this kind of experience even now as we are. You know, we don't have to wait. We shouldn't be waiting. And if you don't mind, I could read this. It's a pretty short paragraph from one of the adjuster papers, where they say that you as a personal creature have mind and will. The adjuster as a pre-personal creature has pre-mind and pre-will. If you so fully conform to the adjuster's mind that you see eye to eye, then your minds become one and you receive the reinforcement of the adjuster's mind. Subsequently, if your will orders and enforces the execution of the decisions of this new or combined mind, the adjuster's pre-personal will attains to personality expression through your decision. And as far as that particular project is concerned, you and the adjuster are one. Your mind has attained to divinity attunement, and the adjuster's will has achieved personality expression. So I'm assuming they're talking about that being possible during this lifetime, even as we now are in this life. So maybe that's a high goal, but it's attainable. Just like the Father's will. We wouldn't be, encouraged to do the Father's will if it was impossible. I mean, the Father's will has to be possible. It wouldn't be something that we're supposed to be doing. It's kind of applies in the same way. And not to say that these achievements don't reach higher levels as we progress, but even now we can begin to know God if that's our desire and we focus
that's
and have
beautiful.
A little heart about it. Yeah.
Amen.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. Well, I wanted to switch it over to those out there that are not into the Urantia revelation and don't really understand God very well. Back on 5:1-2, our Father is not in hiding. He is not in arbitrary seclusion. He has mobilized the resources of divine wisdom in a never-ending effort to reveal himself to the children of his universal domains. Yeah, except that we're in quarantine.
Mm.
Okay?
And
so
what does that
mean? There are a lot of individuals. Well, we are out of touch with the broadcasts. We are orphaned on this planet for both of the people that don't understand this revelation.
Mm.
Yeah. Okay. Doctors, though, are not subject to quarantine.
No, I know. I'm just saying, right, I know.
But no,
it,
yeah,
but,
I mean, just right.
In other words, yeah, but, you know, these people also are not all that aware of the adjusters.
Yeah,
I'm
right.
I'm just trying to put myself in alongside, you know, even my fellow progressive Christians, you know, have a ceiling over their cosmos. And so when this is a never-ending effort to reveal himself to the children, you know, it's like, well, yeah, but he's also protecting his children by keeping them quarantined, you know, when necessary. So, I mean, it gets complicated, you know, and that's just something that, you know, having the revelation is awesome, and I wouldn't want it to be any other way, and yet there are explanations we have to share. You know, it's like there's a lot of content, a lot of
why
complaints out there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, yeah. I think the folks who, you know, the vast majority of humanity who don't have any access to this revelation, they're part of historical and cultural traditions of religious search and sentiment, and many of them, and even those who don't have this concept, they have the concept of the still small voice, the idea of God trying to inspire them and lead them, and them trying to have a sense of what God, how God wishes them to live. That's an idea that is out there in the religious cultures in simple ways. And in that sense, and the degree to which they're desiring to move forward with that sense and try to live in this, in association with it, they're in the same process of formulation that I think we are. I think we may understand it more precisely, and I think that's helpful. That's very helpful to us, and it's why we love this revelation. But I think with less precision and less maybe understanding, I think any sincere person who's searching for a relationship with higher spiritual realities and is attempting to live their lives in consonance with that is involved in this process of formulation. And when they hit the mansion worlds, they're going to get all the revelation that we have in the first mansion world. And they're going to get caught up. You know, there'll be a process of major catching up. And I actually think we might be privileged to serve on those initial mansion worlds in helping our fellows from Urantia, you know, accomplish that catching up process. So it's a matter of, you know, very temporary circumstances of ignorance, I think.
Yeah, it's the vicissitudes are more, what's the word? I don't know. They're more powerful for those that don't have the revelation. You know, they're battered around by the vicissitudes more than we are.
And hard to explain.
Perhaps.
Why things are like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. It gets into the whole theodicy thing.
Yeah, but that's so much a part of what our job is as being ambassadors of the revelation is, you know, helping to soothe the feathers and maybe, you know, extend the vision of our fellows, you know. Anyway.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. I'm just wondering, is that really what the nature of life is? Would that be what we would be experiencing without the revelation, without having this to believe in? What is it that this gave us? You know, a sense of corroborating what we believed about God, that God was out there in the universe. Do people that have strong faith in God not also have this? What is it that we're getting with the revelation? I think you touched on something very important there, And I know, Marvin, you were about to weigh in on something, but let's, we've got about 15 minutes left in the show. Why don't we think about that? Because I think it's a really interesting question about, you know, God's approachability and how important that is vis-a-vis what the revelation is giving us and what we are able to experience as a result of having the revelation versus what many others don't get to. So what do you think? Go ahead, Marvin.
Well, I was thinking, you know, I think all of us are aware that members of our own community have had children who have moved on to the mansion worlds, and that's happened recently to a dear friend. And I think of the passage in the Urantia book where they talk about the struggle for existence and that, and they use the term falter and fail. That's why so many falter and fail, is because they lose hope. You know, they lose a sense of what's possible and that they don't really understand how the struggles of this life and the contrast between good and evil in this life play a part in the larger journey that we're on. And I think, to me, there are three groups of people. There are a very small group of people who are privy to this revelation, who have a pretty full and clear understanding, which for so many of us has been incredibly helpful in navigating the challenges and pitfalls of this life. And then there's a group of people who are established in the religious traditions and find some degree of solace and guidance and inspiration sufficient to carry on with their spiritual growth journeys. And they'll be really uplifted fully, I think, on the early mansion worlds. But then I think there are huge numbers of people who are attempting to live this life without the benefit of either the fifth epical revelation or any real solid immersion in a spiritual tradition. And for that very large group of human beings, life is really, really hard. And eventually for many of them gets to the point they're so demoralized that they just give up. And whether they descend into the drugs and die that way or else, you know, end their lives in a sense of frustration and tragedy, you know, or just struggle on for the rest of their lives and really accomplish very little because they're so kind of pushed down by the hardships of life. They haven't discovered the joys of a spiritual kind of sustenance, either through traditional religion or through the revelation. That's where our ministry lies, I think. That's the lost sheep, you know?
Right. And I think that's
it's all around us.
Yeah. Yes, it is. And that third category is the group that I think is really being touched by what's happening in aspects of Christianity that are making Jesus more approachable, like the chosen, like the projects like the chosen. I mean, people, lost sheep are flocking to these, to know Jesus, to feel the assurance, the blessed assurance. You know, their lives are becoming more meaningful, and you know, and we've got to be careful, you know, with the revelation view that we don't look down on that, because that's really the first thing that Jesus wants us to do is save the lost sheep. and those groups are doing a good job at saving the lost sheep. So and that's one reason why I am paying attention to what's happening on that level, because there's fire out there. It's growing. And, you know, maybe they're not ready for this revelation, but it's all about being ready for God. And that's what we want to encourage on whatever level we can. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, something to tie in with that and maybe go along with that, this comment in the third paragraph of the section where they say, you should rejoice. I love that word. You should rejoice and the recognition of the ever-present possibility of immediate communion with the bestowal spirit of the Father.
Mm.
And
mm.
if we're rejoicing in that, we remember,
yes.
you know, if we're having an experience of that ourselves, where we have this, you know, where we kind of exude or project this feeling of rejoicing, that can have the same sort of influence that you're talking about, I think, and
yes.
with something like
yeah.
The Chosen. You know, if we're not rejoicing in this, then why should they pay any attention to it? You know what I mean?
Right.
Or something,
right.
or something like that. Well, yeah, we can be ambassadors of rejoicing or something.
Absolutely.
In the recognition of what they're talking about. And that is something to rejoice over. And something
oh,
to experience.
Absolutely.
Something to experience,
yes.
obviously, and of course.
Well, it,
but and grow in. But it's also something where we should be rejoicing over this. So that's a brilliant.
I like that. I like that. Because, I mean, in essence, it's a very parental type of appreciation. It's like watching your young child take its first step. You know,
mm.
we rejoice in them being able to stumble over to the coffee table, you know.
Right.
I mean, so it's like it's the same kind of rejoicing, you know. And it's,
well, from,
yeah.
Yeah, you know, from the perspective of the angels, as they look down at all of the struggling human population on our world, if someone comes to a place of genuine interaction with a spirit, right, in the most generic sense, right, they have a sense of spirit presence. And they might conceptualize it as God. They might conceptualize it as the force or whatever. And they're effectively trying to follow that sense and live their lives by it and thereby finding stability and some degree of satisfaction
mm-hmm.
in their lives. Whether
mm-hmm.
it's through the emergent Christian tradition, whether it's through Islam or Buddhism
right.
or Hinduism or any of the other established traditions, or whether it's through the fifth epical revelation, the angels look at a human being trying to live that way and doing so to with sufficient success to make it to the next
mm-hmm.
life. They look at that and they're rejoiced. They're rejoicing. So it's
absolutely.
Like from the angelic point of view, it's every possible avenue of saving
yes.
souls. They're
yes.
they're in support of, and I think they are supporting those many
oh,
avenues.
Fostering
and
fostering, yes.
And to go back to the beginning of our conversation today, I look at what our generation has accomplished. You know, there are tens of thousands, if not more, encounters with the Urantia Revelation online every year. I listen to the Urantia Foundation's latest report. It's happening all over the place. Most of it is really quite unrecognized and not part of the organized Urantia movement. But
mm-hmm.
we have no idea how much
right.
our generation has accomplished in the way of exposure to the world's seeking population in many languages, as you know, Andre, that we have accomplished in our generation. I think we've actually accomplished a lot in establishing the early eras of the impact of this revelation. And I think there are tens of thousands, frankly, of people around the world who are encountering the truth of this revelation, but they're just scattered and they're not really involved in the organized Urantia movement. But I think it's having its impact as well.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's
yeah.
all of the above is what the
mm-hmm.
angels look at.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, I find a lot of comfort in the this comment in the second paragraph, where they say that the majesty of the Father's love causes him to yearn for the association of every created being who can comprehend
mm-hmm.
love or approach him. So remembering that the God is yearning to be associated
yeah.
with me, with
yeah.
me and all of us, of course, but bringing it down to a personal level, that's
yeah.
mm-hmm. a powerful realization. I mean, a revelation, I guess. It's a revelation that leads to a realization. But that there's
yeah.
this reach coming from God to me. You know, it's not
yeah.
God is just off somewhere passively waiting for me to get my whatever together. You know, God is yearning for my association. That to me is just like says so much
yeah.
about the
yes.
nature of God.
Yeah,
and it goes along with the rejoicing idea. You know, that the adjuster has been given for that to help us satisfy the Father's yearning. to be associated. Yes. He doesn't say to control us or to tell us what to do or to become slaves of his some sort of misunderstood concept of his will. It's just a yearning for our association. It's like so sweet, you know. It's like, wow,
yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hang out.
Yeah.
It's beautiful.
It is.
So last thoughts on approachability, our last 3 or 4 minutes here. What do you think is the most important thing for a person to know about the approachability of God, whether or not they have the Urantia book? What will bring a person closer in their relationship to God? Why don't we go around the room? Pam, do you want to start?
Well, what comes to mind is to share that the fact that the God lives within you and give ear. Trust that that's the case. And watch for it.
So that God...
communication with you.
If you don't hear him, what might you tip somebody off to look for?
Well, one of the things that really tips me off is synchronicities.
Ah.
That lets me know that the universe is alive, that I'm in the right place at the right time. Synchronicity. And they happen in little ways, whether what I'm reading is suddenly in the very phrase is on a song, you know, on the radio or something. In other words, disparate kinds of occurrences that are sweet little validations of little aha moments. So synchronicities, I guess, would be one indicator. Just an openness to watch for.
Yeah.
To trust that he is actually out there wanting to reach you. And
wonderful.
That now it's up to you to open up to see how true that is. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Conversation. It's a conversation, basically.
So as someone that the radio spoke to, I won't go into that.
Whoever.
Go ahead, Chuck, and then Marvin closes off.
Yeah, I was just going to say.
Take a minute, though.
That we shouldn't be too hung up on hearing voices in our head. You know, I don't think the right.
I know
you agree. Yeah. And that what we're really going for is the feeling of the presence of God.
Yes.
Quite achievable.
Good.
That's weak. And they say in the personality survival paper that personality responds directly to other personality presence. So we can enjoy this engagement of personality presence with the Father independently of, you know, hearing messages or voices or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that feeling of being with God is just so fruitful of so much. You know, it's just such a pleasure, such an uplifting feeling of, yes, I'm not alone. God walks by my side. You know, that whole sensing of the presence of God, I think is maybe more where the emphasis should be put.
Mm-hmm.
Very good. Thank you for that. And Marvin?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think for me the key takeaway is that A, God is a person, and that God wants to be in living relationship with me, wants to share life with me. And that when you put that together with that God is inside of me and wants basically nothing more than to be in relationship with me and interacting with me all the time, every moment. And my duty then becomes to try to remember that and respond positively to that desire that God has for me and with me. That's the key takeaway. So we're on our way.
We are, and what a wonderful 3 positive notes for all of us to end wonderful broadcast about the approachability of God. Thank you very much,
you,
Marvin Gowron, Chuck Thurston, and Pam Chaddock. Thank you so much.
Yes.
We will be with you next week.
Yeah. Your thoughts, Andre? Any closing thoughts?
My thoughts will not be contained in the broadcast because we are down to our last 2 seconds.
No time.
All right.
But I'll just say I agree with all three of you, and look forward to having three of you on the broadcast. Paula will be back along with you, Marvin, and you, Pam, and Chuck, and I will be at IC23, actually on the back end of IC23 next Saturday. I'll still be out there in Chicago and look forward to joining you all in a couple of weeks. So until then, I'm Andre Rodetas, and we will see you in next week on the Cosmic Citizen. Bye for now. Love you all.
Thank you all. Love you all.
Have a great week. You all. Mm-hmm.
Love you all. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.